Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars sponsored by WEPA. Join NITP for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this Monday, May 11th in the AM, but we're archived, so we might be talking to you when you're listening sometime other than May 11th in the morning. And we're going to be talking with Kathy Lavender from SI Placement. And Kathy is a recruiter. Hi, Tammy. Tammy Flanagan came in, and Tammy's going to join us. And Tammy's Senior Benefit Director, NITP, GovExec columnist, and Tan.
Good morning.
Good morning. All righty. So, Kathy, recruiting in today's world, we're federal-based, dealing with people coming out of the government or people that want to come into the government. And I know you have a bent towards security and the like, but you've done it all. Is that fair to say?
I think that is fair to say. I always call myself the queen of reinvention because I've had several careers. Excuse me, I've got allergies this morning, too. I think like a lot of population in the D.C. area in particular. It's a heavy pollen season, of course. But, Bob, I have done broadcast journalism, private investigation, and for the last 15 years, I have been recruiting for investigators and security personnel. And I'm based in the D.C. area, actually in Bethesda, but I work with clients around the country and around the world. And I have filled positions that really fall within those two big umbrellas. And as you might imagine, when it comes to security and investigations and all that falls under those umbrellas, people who have had federal experience are often very qualified for some of those roles. So I interact a lot with people who have either had full careers and have gone into retirement, or people who are leaving early for whatever reason. So they can step away because they're chomping at the bit to get into the private sector, or they could be looking for their second career. So I've been exposed to the federal workforce, public workforces really across the country. So it's great of you to have me. I really appreciate this chance to talk with you and Tammy.
Well, Tammy, the retired Fed, I would say, would be a good hire. Maybe I shouldn't say that because I'm not in your industry. But with Tammy's knowledge of benefits, if she was to tutor some of these people, they might be able to get a greater compensation level because they don't have to pay for some of the benefits that the retired Fed gets, like health insurance.
Yeah, I've always heard, and maybe you can confirm if that's true, because I think somebody coming out of federal service who is actually retiring already has health insurance, they've got life insurance, they don't really need those benefits. So is that a real plus when it comes to the employer's angle looking at that recruit?
Absolutely. You know, they can decline the benefits. They'll usually keep certain ones, like the 401k, of course. But for the standard benefits, they decline it. And I always tell my candidates when they're in the negotiation stage that they can usually try to ascertain what the benefits package monetary value is and seek cash comp to make up for that. So it is a plus. But you know, of course, when they come out with their years of experience, they generally have a higher price tag.
That's true.
So, you know, it's kind of six of one, half dozen of the other. It can help you, it can hurt you. Because quite honestly, sometimes I think federal retirees and public sector retirees more generally can be kind of frustrated when they start to look because they may be considered overqualified. And I tell people all the time, you know, the job specification calls for anywhere between 7 to 10 years of experience or 15 to 20 years of experience, and it's comped for that level. Therefore, they're not looking for somebody who's got 25 to 30. You've got a higher price tag. So that's one of the obstacles that they have to confront. And it's a harsh reality in some cases.
Okay. And outside of that that group, generally federal retirees looking for full-time work, or do you ever work part-time work?
Yeah, absolutely. Not typically, but you know what I do is sometimes help clients find people who can work as independent contractors. So those who are looking for 1099 work would absolutely have options as a retiree. I tell them, you know, don't overlook this option, because actually you could find that you want to cut back your schedule a little bit. Maybe you don't want to get back into the full-time grind and work, you know, 40, 50, 60 hours a week, which is not uncommon in the private sector. So maybe you want to be a 1099 contractor, and therefore you can work anywhere between 20, 30, whatever number of hours you're interested in working, as long as the company that's using you as a 1099 is okay with a reduced schedule. And I find that there's plenty of opportunities to do that. I've had a lot of luck placing, let's say, former FBI agents or people with financial investigative backgrounds, say from the IRS Criminal Investigation Division, in banks for particular projects, often called lookbacks, where they're trying to respond to a federal issue that regulators have raised concerns about some of their anti-money laundering, anti-terrorist financing efforts. So they bring in a cadre of independent contractors, the consulting firm that's hired for this project, and they are diving in and looking back at what the pattern and practices and accounts and account holders are all about. And they may be intensely working for 5 months, 6 months, a year, 18 months. And a lot of people love that flexibility. And they can fly in and fly out. These consulting firms usually provide housing for them and give them, you know, trips back home. So that's a great way to kind of bridge that gap. These are not people looking for full-time employment, but looking for part-time employment. And they can command actually a higher salary because their hourly rate is higher in those situations. So it's a win-win for everybody. They get the expertise and knowledge that these people have while they're not locked down into one environment and one job.
Kathy, I had a question last week. It just so happens, I usually don't get these questions, but I was at NSA, which of course is security. And this guy was there, a very high-level senior employee who is thinking about leaving the agency before he can retire. He's only been there 10 years, but he's at that stage in his life where he still wants to work another 15 years. And he's trying to put a monetary value on the benefits that he leaves behind as a federal employee versus, you know, the benefit of going out into the private sector to finish his career. And one of his biggest concerns was the fact that if he resigns and doesn't retire, he's going to lose his health insurance. He will have a small retirement, even though he's not retiring immediately. But is there any way you help people put a value on those benefits of federal service when they're thinking about going out to the private sector before retirement?
It's an important consideration and a calculation that I'm not qualified to provide. I mean, that would be something I'm sure you could help with. But I think it's an important element of the consideration before look before you leap in this situation, because you do have to factor in a lot of different things. But I will tell you, I hear from plenty of people who from, you know, places like the NSA or the CIA, their skill sets are in demand. They're they're very sought after, particularly if they have a cyber focus. So I always tell them, you know, try to figure out the calculation of what how long it will take you to get past that loss of some of the benefits that you have and the retirement package that you're stepping away from. But given how lucrative some of the private sector jobs are these days, they can get over that hurdle very quickly. And it's pretty much a no-brainer, because the private sector is seeking these people and trying to get them on board as quickly as they can to deal with these issues. You know, cybersecurity has kind of become the tail wagging the dog. And there is such demand for talent. And just to give you a quick example, I had a candidate go in with a multinational company in the Midwest on Thursday of this past week, interview all day. And he contacted me Friday afternoon and said, I have a verbal job offer in hand and I'm accepting. And that's fast. Less than 24 hours, he had a very good opportunity that gave him a very nice bump in compensation, and the benefits are going to be generous. And they saw he was a good fit. They needed to lock him down, and they move quickly. Now, not a lot of jobs come along that fast and that quickly and that easily and that seamlessly. But if you have the right skill set, your head could spin at how fast you could be snapped up.
Wow.
Looking at employment versus self-employment, the 1099 type, do you ever counsel and say, okay, if you have the 1099 package, these will be your benefits, but these are the tax benefits? Taxes should never come first, but they can set up a pretty robust retirement plan if they're truly...
Absolutely, for themselves. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And they can also do some other expenditures, but I would say the retirement plan would be the major draw. And some will say, well, I can write off expenses. And I go, yeah, but only if you pay for them. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't make sense to pay a dollar just to get a tax deduction
right.
dollar.
Exactly.
You want to net as much as you can.
Yeah. Well, one consideration, Bob, is that many of my clients, because they're big multinationals and they've been around a long time, the older the company, the more likely they are to have their own pension. And I have a couple of clients right now that offer their pension plan with either a 3, 4, or 5 year vesting. That's a really generous low threshold for vesting. And so, you know, if you've given up a pension on the federal side, but you can get into a private sector pension and you can earn a lot more money and you can still get benefits and you can invest in a 401k with a company match, I find that, you know, that can make a huge difference, and why not?
Okay, now for our listeners that don't know what vesting is, if a company puts a dollar away for you and it's a 5-year vest, ignoring some of the tricks, each year that you worked, you'd earn 20%, so that at the end of the 5th year, you'd earn 100% of what the company put away. They still put the money away, but it might not be yours if you left early, but if you stay late, it is yours.
Yeah, and it might not be yours fully until you fully vest. You could have tiers of vesting, too. Mm-hmm. But look at that, and then look at whether you're going to get company stock or stock options. Now, that's another sweetener that the private sector has, and it can be very substantial. And again, that has a vesting schedule, either tiered or with a cliff vesting. But those are gifts of cash if you stay long enough to get it. And you know, if your company's stock is doing well, if they pay a dividend, there's, you know, just a lot of attractive elements there on the compensation consideration that you really do have to take into consideration. And I think it can get people over the hurdle. And if anything, with the kind of recruiting practice that I have, I tend to see more people stepping away as opposed to staying for the full term. It's just a pattern that I see. Maybe I'm getting the rebellious ones or the adventurous ones.
I think that was the design of the new retirement system for federal employees, was to create a more flexible and portable workforce. So you're not necessarily seeing government employees who start out of school and stay until retirement. We see a lot of that movement in and out of federal service into the private sector.
Exactly. Oh. And I know people who go back to federal agencies on a different status as contractors, and, you know, they're essentially doing the same job that they did beforehand, but with a different name across the check. And I always counsel those folks who've retired and then gone back into their agencies, probably with a pay raise, but to think about whether that is really the smart option for the long term. Mm-hmm. It's the easy option. It's the path of least resistance. But if you really do plan to work 15 or 20 years in retirement, it kind of locks you into that world in perpetuity. So I always tell people, if you are of a mind to make a clean break, make a clean break. Dive feet first, both feet, into the private sector. Learn what the for-profit environment is all about. It's going to be a bit of an education. It's going to be a shock. And I always say it's a roller coaster, so buckle your seatbelts. But it can be fun. It can be stimulating. And for people who are just sort of feel like they're in kind of a Groundhog Day scenario at work, where every day is the same, or some people have had 1 year of experience times 30 years, and they are bored to tears and ready for a change, they're incredibly grateful for the dynamic environment. And, you know, it's a merit-based environment. And if you're not cutting it, you could be out on the street. But if you're a go-getter and who wants to have that kind of professional challenge at any point in your life and career, then the private sector is for you.
Well, how could somebody position themselves? Because I remember, this dates me very far back, but in 1981, I took a class I was working in the government back then, and I took this class on secretarial skills or something taught by a private sector professor. And the one thing she told us, she says, if you stay in government too long, the private sector won't want you.
Right.
Because you have this reputation of just what you said, where you kind of get stagnant and you stay in the same type of role. Is there still that stigma to someone coming out of federal service who's been there for 20 or 30 years that maybe they're not going to be the go-getter or the person who wants to work for merit raises rather than just time and grade?
Right, exactly. Yes, I think there is, unfortunately. And it's a, you know, kind of an unfair situation for many people. But the reality is that there's kind of a shelf life notion at work. And in some of the federal agencies that I recruit from, people have the option to leave at, say, 50 when they've got their years in, or stay to 57 when they're mandatory. And people ask me all the time, should I stay the full to 57, or should I leave when I get an opportunity? And I always advise them, leave early. It's always better because you want a longer runway in the private sector. The private sector is not looking to bring somebody in at 57, invest in the training, the go through the orientation, the adjustment period, because it can be bumpy, and really bring that person into their environment and their culture and lead them through that whole process, and then say, you know, and I'm retiring at 62. Yeah. And so it's not attractive to them. And so I really think that they ought to look for those options when they can.
Okay, welcome back to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning with Kathy Lavender. The reason I said, oops, a lot of people listen to this not in the morning. And Tammy Flanagan, who just said, can I say something?
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to follow up because before the break, we were talking about this stigma of federal employees going to the private sector. So I'm wondering, is there anything you could tell a federal employee who's thinking about making this transition of what they can do to position themselves better, make themselves look like that person that the private sector company wants to recruit?
Yes, absolutely. There are a couple of things I would say. One of the issues I see with people who've really kind of had the full career and they've risen to a certain level of management and responsibility, the biggest mistake I think I see on resumes is the headline on there that says senior level executive. Not everybody needs a senior level executive. There are a lot of managers already in the private sector. And you may find that you don't want to manage people when you really think about it and explore what you're really doing and want to do next. And so consider individual contributor roles. That's the first thing. Adjust to the fact that, you know, I managed a staff of 40 people and I had the title of X and I was a very high up person in the government. Well, you know, that and $3 will get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks, unfortunately. They're looking for practical applications of your knowledge and skill set. And federal workers do have very specific knowledge and expertise, and they may have great broader experience than they realize. So sometimes they have to broaden it out beyond their experience in a particular environment and sell certain things in their resumes and their job interviews. Things like project management, budget management, people management, or a particular and maybe arcane expertise. And certainly this comes into play in the security arena and the investigative arena with people who are experts in, anti-terrorist financing that banks may want, or executive protection that multinationals may want. And there are, threat intelligence that all kinds of companies need these days, including cyber threats and physical threats. So they have very specific and deep knowledge. They've been the benefit of a lot of training. If the training can be listed in their resume and broadened out so that it can demonstrate that they have this really deep knowledge of some critical areas, they can be head and shoulders above somebody in the private sector. You know, the private sector does not invest in its people in the same way the government does. Mm-hmm. So I always say that's a huge selling point. And I always suggest that people in the public sector maintain a training log throughout your career. Start with the first year that you're an employee.
That's easy. You get certificates for every training class you go to.
Exactly. And you put them in a file folder and you've maybe never made an electronic document. So have a training log. Mm-hmm. And then when you're going for a particular job, you edit it and say, here is some of the relevant training that I've had. You don't put it on your resume. You don't attach it and send it separately. But if you get an interview at that point in time, as you're leaving, Thanksgiving, you say something like, in the government, I've been really fortunate. I've been the beneficiary of a lot of outstanding training. And here's just a brief summary of what I've done that could be relevant to your needs. Mm-hmm. Now, that puts you head and shoulders above some of the private sector competition. But, I think the other mistake I see is that the resumes are sometimes too inside baseball. Mm-hmm. They use acronyms and terminology. And sometimes people have done things that the private sector just doesn't care about. You know, counter-nuclear proliferation. Well, that's not going to resonate. even counter-terrorism, which is, you know, obviously a big mission for the government these days. So flip it on flip it on its head and find that, you know, you're emphasizing your threat intelligence and you're responding to threats and that kind of thing. So I think you have to kind of put it in the context of what they're looking for. And I'll see resumes sometimes because it's in the security realm where people were in canine units or SWAT teams or whatever. And I always say to people, look, things would have to be going very, very badly for this corporation to need your SWAT skills. And let's hope that they don't. So you've got to broaden it out and talk about what you have done and what you know.
Basically,
that's relevant
about what you
to them.
Can offer that corporation.
Exactly.
Rather than what you've done in your federal career.
Exactly. It's about your value proposition. And that's the one thing that if I, you know, could hammer home one point today, is that every resume should start with a couple of sentences at the top of the resume that connects the dots in someone's career and talks about their value proposition. This is your chance, not your cover letter, but on your resume, to sell what you bring to the table. And be careful and aware that there are notions about what the federal government is like. And the biggest misconception is that everybody has huge budgets, unlimited resources, and that they're going to be ill-equipped and not necessarily easy to adapt to a lean for-profit environment. And, you know, we know that that's a joke. The government has limited resources and certainly fewer resources in many agencies these days. So you have to talk about your ability to manage when there is, you know, declining numbers of people on your team, where there's pressures for increased worker productivity.
How important is it to be a subject matter expert rather than a generalist? Because it seems like I'm seeing in some agencies where I go where people will work 2 years in this job and then they go to another job for 2 years and they're learning a whole bunch of different skill sets, like they're a whatever that saying goes, I'm a
master of a jack of all
a jack
trades,
of all trades, master of
none.
Nothing.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah,
but then
yeah.
You have other people who will spend 30 years, you know, focused, hyper focused on one line of work. So what would be more attractive to the employer? Someone who's done a whole bunch of different things, maybe in the area of human resources or in your case in security, or is it someone who's really a subject matter expert in this one detailed area? I guess it might depend on what the employer is looking for, I suppose.
You're right. It does depend to some degree, but generally in the kinds of roles that I recruit for, I would say the SMEs are going to have an advantage because they have a deep knowledge and expertise that the private sector is craving, that mm-hmm. they need, and they maybe can't get anywhere else. Where the generalists can have some impact is in certain environments like professional services, consulting, where they love to have the people with broad experience.
Right.
And they can, it's a multidisciplinary approach to begin with. So you bring in somebody who's shown that they're adaptable and flexible. And by the way, those two words should be on everybody's resume if you really are adaptable and flexible, because that, in a nutshell, is what the private sector is all about. I can't tell you how often my clients reorg. Position, change course. And, you know, the people who are in the private sector are going to have to be able to do that.
Right. Do you find, or have you found, where, let's say, one of your clients is looking for somebody and they put this mask on, that they really want somebody coming out of the federal government that has contractual ties to the agency? So what I found on the other side, you know, doing their tax work, is they have this ability to be able to bid contracts. But after 3 or 4 years, their ties to the agency are not there, and they may not be working anymore.
Right. Well, there's a shelf life issue there. Yeah. And that can be the case. But what I always say is go back to what the core responsibilities that you had throughout that time? And was it intelligence gathering, team management? Look at those kinds of things, because those are still things that you can sell. So it is all about what you can sell to the private sector. And you have to, it's not what you want to sell. It's not what you want to do. And I hear from people all the time who say, and in my next career, I want to.
Yeah.
And I always just say, stop right there. It's not about what you want to. It's what they need. They are driving the bus. They're writing the checks. They're making the decisions. So you have to figure out what you're selling. Very simple. It's a buyer's market for certain things. And here's the other problem that some people who are leaving the federal government will encounter. Because we have this demographic bubble, the baby boom generation, and they're retiring. They've already started, and you know this as well as I do. They're going to be retiring even bigger numbers over the next, let's say, 8 to 10 years. To many people who don't really understand federal job titles, federal agencies, federal operations, they all look the same. And it's like, I can't tell one from the other. And I have been amazed at the comments from certain people, the gatekeepers in human resources in many of these companies, or talent acquisition, as they like to call it these days, with, you know, I can't really tell, you know, I might put something on Indeed and get 90 resumes the first day, and I need your help because I can't even understand their resumes. So they are completely lost when it comes to understanding what these titles mean. And they don't, you know, you could say you were in senior executive service and that means nothing to them.
What's the thing that gets a recruiter's attention when they look at a resume? Is it the type of font or the type of paper, or is it what's on the front, or is it better if it comes email versus by snail mail?
You know, oh, it should definitely come email. No one uses snail mail anymore. That is so last century.
People coming out of government still use paper in many
definitely.
Cases.
And, you know, I see these government-focused resumes where they've put their supervisor's name and phone number and their reason for leaving and their pay and pay grades. And pay grades mean nothing in the private sector. I happen to know a little bit more about that than most people, but I guarantee you that most people in the private sector do not have a clue. You know, GS-14
means
nothing.
Plus, you don't talk about your pay in the private sector, right, like we do in the government?
No, absolutely not. That's taboo. But so what they need to do is have a very distilled message. And here's the hard part. If you've had a lengthy career, let's say even if you've had 10 years, you still have to boil it down to about a page and a half or 2 pages max. And it has to be very, very focused. And you have to connect the dots. You cannot expect anybody to parse your resume like it's some sort of Dead Sea Scrolls, and they're going to figure out what you did. They will not take that time. You know, the research shows that most recruiters, hiring managers, and HR talent acquisition people spend less than 30 seconds looking at a resume. That's why I like to have that opening executive summary. You don't really call it that, but that opening paragraph that is your message, because I guarantee you, I'll read those. Mm-hmm. I may still, you know, put it in a file, an electronic file, and not necessarily return to it, but at least I know what that person's done. So connect the dots, tell them what you've done, what you can do. And it's really, see, the biggest mistake is people think a resume is an employment history. It is not. It is a marketing document, and it's got to be a really good one. So it has to be very polished. And, you know, if you're still using WordPerfect and it looks like something from the 1980s or whatever, and it's badly formatted and looks homemade, that's one of the first things I tell people. This looks like, you know, homemade resume with just not a lot of, I don't want it to be flashy, but I want it to look super polished, very professional, very concise. And then you've got, here's the most fundamental thing. You've got to have an email that is a work-related email. I got one not long ago with beachpartygirl@yahoo.com. That's not a good email. You know, first name, last name, and Gmail or Yahoo or whatever, Hotmail, you choose, and then name the file with your name and then the word resume. Because I've gotten resumes that say dad's resume. And just suggests lack of technology skills, lack of understanding about how things are done these days. And they're not hiring your son or daughter who put your resume together for you. They want to hire you, hopefully.
Yeah, could I ask you two conflicting questions?
Okay.
What would you find the trait was of an individual that left federal service and was successful in the transition and say, oh, it was a piece of cake? And the opposite side of that, the same candidate with the same skills but couldn't make the change found it very difficult to continue working.
Right. That's a great question, and it is really right to the heart of the matter. So, Bob, I would say that the ones that have succeeded brilliantly because they bring drive and ambition and energy, and they are fully embracing their new environment, and they're not always living in the past, and they're not going into meetings telling war stories about what they did in the government, but they're really engaged, and they love this new chapter of their life. And I can hear it in their voices when they tell me they're ready for this next chapter and they couldn't be more excited about it. And those are the people who just flourish in this environment because you can come in and do very well and make a lot of money, have a lot of impact, be highly respected and regarded by senior executives. So those are the people who view themselves as business partners, who speak in a business language, who bring business acumen. And there are plenty of people in the federal government or public sector generally who have these skills, but you have to sell that. Now, the ones who I have seen fail, and by the way, I get a lot of searches that are very discreet and I can never, you know, publicly advertise them or anything like that. I have to network to find the right people because I'm replacing somebody who thought it was a retirement job, who thought it was going to be a place where they could put their feet up on the desk, be the gray-haired eminence, you know, exercise kind of a command and control approach to their workforce. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work that way. And I heard from a multinational company, a client called me last week, and I had placed somebody in a role with him 2 months ago. And I said, how's he doing? And he said, you know, he's getting used to having freedom and autonomy. He said he's learning that we're not waiting to tell him what to do.
Yeah.
We're not waiting. He shouldn't wait around for us to tell him when
Who's
to go
your
to
next
lunch,
assignment. Yeah.
What his next assignment is going to be, that he has to take ownership. And he said he's a smart guy and he's getting it. But we had to almost explicitly say, this is your job. Now mm-hmm. take the ball and run with it. Because he was used to an environment where he was heavily managed and controlled. And this is the opposite. And so I always say to people, if there's one thing that you can demonstrate that you are ready for this, use the term unplug and play. I can ramp up immediately. I do not need a lot of supervision and handholding. Yes, I can work collaboratively. Yes, I will seek buy-in. Yes, I will communicate with other stakeholders. I know I cannot operate unilaterally. And the other thing that my clients always talk about in these large corporations is we are a heavily matrixed company. We are a heavily matrixed environment. And so that means whenever decisions are made, there are a lot of people who get to weigh in on that. Now, that can be very different than what they've had in the public sector. So you have to demonstrate that you're able to do that, to work
Make
in that,
that transition.
Environment.
Yeah, I guess it goes both ways. Somebody coming from the private sector into federal service may have a hard transition, too, if they're used to having that freedom and now they have to report up the chain of command.
Absolutely. Yeah. I have seen that as well. And, you know, people
do recruit both ways?
No, I don't. I don't work with the government at all. So, I mean, it's a great talent hunting pool for me. Mm-hmm. So it's one of my happy hunting grounds for the right people. But I don't want to work with the government because I just know that the private sector is so easy. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit out there. There's a lot of need. And I get all my work through referrals and a lot of return repeat business from clients. So they keep me more than busy. And I also just want to explain how recruiters work. Most people who have been in the government have never used a recruiter, never understand what a recruiter does. Some people call us headhunters, and that's perfectly fine. It's not necessarily the most polite term, but I'm totally fine with it. It doesn't bother me. I like the idea of, you know, having some pelts or whatever. But at any rate, a recruiter does not work for the job seeker. A recruiter is not paid by any job seeker. And if there's ever a recruiter who wants a job seeker to pay them money, head for the exits, just head right in the opposite direction, because you should not have to pay a recruiter for anything. If a recruiter helps you, it's a wonderful thing. The stars have aligned. They have found something that works for you, and everybody's happy, and it's a feel-good moment, and it's a great, great outcome. But a recruiter hears from many, many people, and there's a small percentage of people that will actually get contacted again for a job opportunity based on the job specifications that the recruiter gets from the employers who are their clients.
All righty, welcome back. We're here with Kathy Lavender, Executive Director, SI Placement, Tammy Flanagan, knower of all things federal, and you know benefits. I mean, you probably could teach a course on federal benefits.
You think? Maybe. If I tried real hard.
Yeah, just real hard, yeah. All righty, and so we're going to open up the phone lines. We're at 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. Tammy, you had a question at the break.
Well, there was a question that came in. I didn't know if you didn't get to this question yet, did you?
No.
Oh, okay. So somebody had wrote in before the show, and they wanted to know about, you know, they know your angle is on security investigations and so forth, but what about for federal employees who aren't in those particular fields? Like somebody who's worked 30 years for Social Security Administration, had direct public contact positions, is there any kind of a place for them to go when they retire from federal service? Or are there recruiters or companies who are looking for just good, solid workers who just want to, you know, have a second career?
I think there are. You'd have to, you know, ferret them out. You'd have to research and look specifically for recruiters who do that. And what I would say is I think there's a place for everybody as long as you still have a real drive and want to contribute. And you can't, you know, go in it kind of half-heartedly and think that, you know, you're owed something or that, you know, somebody's going to give you a make work job or something like that. But again, my advice is to broaden out the experience, take it out of just the language, the context of the agency that you worked in, and make it broad, make it into project management, people management, budget management. You know, maybe you have some arcane expertise that employers need. And in terms of Social Security, I'm sure there must be some companies, you know, some benefits advisory companies could need someone like that. Now, here's the most important advice I could give you about trying to find and expand your network. Presumably, your network, when you're getting ready to exit, is mainly your peers within your agency. So it's pretty limited. So LinkedIn, the social media site, is where the action is these days. It's a very legitimate, very professional environment. This is not Facebook. People are not, you know, sharing things about their vacation or kids or dogs. And they are networking with people who have either an interest in some of the things that they're working on, an expertise in some of the things they're working on, or just people that they think could have some long-term value. So as a recruiter, of course, I'm on LinkedIn quite a bit, and I can search via keywords. So if you haven't set up a LinkedIn profile before you retire, do it as you're getting ready to. Be very careful if you're in an agency that is super secret, has a lot of you know, information that would not be disseminated, should not be disseminated, definitely be discreet. I've seen people who've come out of CIA or NSA just put the government, and that's totally fine because most of us get what that means. But never be indiscreet on LinkedIn, but you can choose in the drop-down boxes up to, I think, 50 words that describe what your areas of expertise are. And because recruiters search by those skill sets and knowledge sets, you could be found that way. And then you should not overlook LinkedIn groups. LinkedIn groups is the secret sauce of LinkedIn. You can join up to 50 groups, I think, and maybe it's even more these days. I'm in and out of groups all the time based on what I'm looking for. But find those groups that are either functionally aligned, geographically aligned, or just areas of interest that you want to connect with. And if you want to get noticed on LinkedIn groups, share articles, start discussions, connect with people that you see on those groups, and it will have benefits, I believe. And The other thing about LinkedIn groups that most people don't realize, who are either inexperienced or non-users of LinkedIn, is that employers put and recruiters put all kinds of jobs on LinkedIn groups. So there are job announcements there. And the other tool, the must-use tool, is Indeed. Indeed.com is a web crawler that will, once you've signed up and you create an account and it's free, it will crawl the web and scoop up jobs that are responsive to the functional areas and also the geographic areas that you have highlighted that you want to focus on. You can get an email in your inbox either daily or weekly, and those are great tip sheets, and it's free.
If you get a job through either a recruiter or through Indeed or any of the other services, is there a commitment you make to that recruiter, to that company, once you take the job, or are you hired by the company and that's the end of the recruiting?
No obligation there. These are just win-wins for everybody. When I recruit for my clients, the companies, the employers, they usually ask me to give a six-month guarantee that the person will still be there after 6 months. And if they leave for any reason or get asked to leave, God forbid, that doesn't happen very often, I must tell you.
I wouldn't
think. No, because I'm a good recruiter. But at any rate, if they leave, I would have to find a replacement candidate that was acceptable to them. But, that's my obligation to them. But job seekers really do not have an obligation beyond, if you accept an offer and you've, committed verbally and then in writing and you're starting to go through the background screening, maybe drug screening, whatever it is, you're really obligated. Mm-hmm. And I've had a few people who have ignored those commitments and, closer to start date said something like, and I found another job in the meantime and I've accepted that one. Well, that is a huge no-no. And it is, something that could have some long-term repercussions because word gets around that your word is not your bond. And that, it's also a character and integrity issue. And, by the way, I recruit for jobs that are all integrity jobs. So people have to have the utmost character and integrity to get these jobs. So your word really is your bond. And I have a really long memory.
Okay. When somebody lists a reference, could you coach the reference on what to say or not to say when the prospective employer interviews them?
My thought about reference is you put the comments in context. So you give them the job in brief. You don't have to share the position description, but inevitably the person who's checking the reference, that could be me, it could be somebody in HR, it could even be the hiring manager. But they'll want to talk about the person's suitability for that specific job. So the way to prepare them is to just talk about, and I will be doing X, Y, and Z, and they want me for this. Mm-hmm. So be responsive about that and, be focused and be honest. I always like to hear a reference who will say, here are their strengths. Here's what I would say is very relevant. And there's always the question that comes up, well, do they have any weaknesses, shortfalls, or things they should work on? And if somebody does have something that is not a deal breaker, that, this person still needs to work more on, let's say, time management or whatever it is, that's an honest response. I'll probe more on that, but I want to make sure that this person isn't, their desk is not a mess and they're not in a state of chaos and confusion at all times. But it's fine because we all have things to work on. We're not perfect and we're all a work in progress.
Okay, so how does one get in touch with you or learn more about you?
Oh, thanks, Bob. Well, the website is SI Placement. S is in Sierra, I is in India, and the word placement spelled out .com.
Okay.
And I am always happy to hear from new people. If you have an expertise in security or investigations, anything within those two big umbrella categories, you're in my recruiting niche. I would be particularly happy to hear from you. If you're in some other area of government that's non-related, I may tell you I'm not the best person to help you. But you know, I am always happy to hear from people and always try to respond.
I would imagine whatever we just said, although it was focused one way, it would go the other way for somebody to prep when they're looking to change. It can't change your attitude, but change your focus. And,
right.
And
preparation is the key. You know, there's a lot of research, a lot of legwork. People frequently think that they can outsource their job search, that they can hand it off to a recruiter. Fallacy, not mm-hmm. true. They think that they can use a resume distribution system that shotguns your resumes to people like me, to recruiters and HR specialists and talent acquisition people. That is another terrible way to try to find a job, because I can see that they come through certain resume services. And at that point in time, I've lost interest in them because they haven't taken the time to do a bespoke job search, and they're trying to shortcut it and take the easy way out. And what does that say about somebody? It means they probably take the easy way out in a lot of time, a mm-hmm. lot of ways. And I'm not looking for anybody to take the easy way out. There is no easy way. There are no magic seeds that you can plant to make that job grow on the beanstalk. It is a lot of work to find another job. So you're going to have to be extremely industrious, smart, and proactive.
Visually, when somebody goes for an interview, I mean, I'm late in the career, let's mm-hmm. put it that way. And, you know, it's, you know,
first
a tie. That's
yeah.
right. And, you know, a tie. And but do people not wear ties
or
dresses?
Hair dyed or...
I'm not going to answer that last one. But
I've known
think
someone
you...
who did that when he was looking for a job. I was like, I didn't recognize him. I was like, holy smokes, you look 20 years younger.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You want to look put together. You want to make sure you're wearing, you know, business appropriate attire. A lot of environments are business casual these days, but a job interview is not a business casual setting. So yes, you have to have a tie. Everything has to be pressed. Your shoes have to be polished. Your nails have to be cut. Your hair has to be cut. Your grooming has to be impeccable because they're judging you on all of those things. Do you fit into our environment? Do you look like a person who would represent this company well in public interactions? And you have to look the part. And, you know, if you've let yourself go and you walk into a job interview, I had a cybersecurity person a few years ago who just looked like a total schlub. There's no other way to describe it. He had mustard on his tie. And I think that tie had been in his drawer for 10 years or 20 years, maybe. And it was rumpled and dirty. And I was disgusted. Mm-mm. And I thought to myself, as soon as I could extract myself from that interview, that there's no way I'm ever submitting this person because he didn't care enough to look the part.
Okay. So I have to throw my ties out if I'm looking, and maybe bleach the white shirt. And
yes. Get it, you know, nice starch at the cleaner, right? You want to look very put together. Exactly.
Buy a new shirt.
Right. A new shirt. Exactly. Whoa. Exactly.
All right. And then once you're in the door, you don't necessarily have to look like that, but you want to get in the door.
You do. And, you know, you have to get past the phone screen first, though, Bob. And the phone screen is where you have to do a lot of research and preparation. And you have to have, you know, you're going to talk to somebody in HR. So you're going to have a notepad in front of you with your distilled talking points. So have those ready. And then when you get in the door, again, you have to have a focus message. I have a terrible story. Someone sat down and the first question was, tell me about yourself. An hour later, he was just getting into the mid part of his career they said, we have to wrap up.
So
never give your life story.
Permanently. And talking about wrapping up, we have less than a minute. So final comments, Kathy?
Well, I think there are jobs for people out there, but they have to be savvy about them. And there's nothing owed to you when you're making the transition. You're going to have to go out and be a hunter and beat the bushes and be competitive and be aggressive and be smart, because you do, in all likelihood, have knowledge and skills that are needed, but you're going to have to stand out from the pack. And those people who just think that throwing out resumes or constantly editing their resumes will be sorely disappointed, because they're not going to get results from the, you know, 10th iteration of their resume. The resume is only a tool to get your foot in the door, get that interview.
All righty, Tammy?
I'm sending this radio show to my son who's looking for a job. He may learn something very valuable.
All righty. Thanks, Kathy. Thanks, Tammy. Thanks for you all listening, and we'll be back next week. See you then. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP and sponsored by WEPA. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. This show can also be heard on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search For Your Benefit. Thanks for listening.